This is a CBC podcast.
The provincial election may be over, but there are still a couple of races that are too close to call. We won't get those results for a week or so. But whatever the final numbers, we know a couple of things for sure. The opposition NDP has nearly doubled its seats. Has now. And despite another majority government, the Saskatchewan Party is going to be looking for some new cabinet ministers. For more on this week's election news, we've reached our panel again. Adam Hunter covers politics for CBC Saskatchewan, and Murray Mandrick writes a political column in the Regina Leader Post. Hi, guys.
Sick of us yet?
Sick of me yet?
Never.
Please come in again. But there's always something to talk about. And Adam, what is the latest when it comes to those results?
Yeah, so in Saskatchewan, there's been this wait for the mail-in ballots, and it's the normal process. So we're still waiting until November 9th. That's next Saturday for the final count. So they're giving people, final chance. If they mail their ballots in before the deadline, they'll count those ballots. What we know based on the first mail-in ballot count is that there was one flipped race, and that's Saskatoon Westview, where David Buckingham had a 31-vote lead going into those mail-in ballots. Now he trails April Chief Calf by 37 votes. The NDP has been outperforming the Saskatchewan Party in mail-in ballots, so they've actually increased their margins in almost every race. Election Saskatchewan considered 9 races basically too close. They don't call it that, but that was the margin of the margin of the vote with the mail-in ballots still to come. Now, CBC this week has chopped off basically 5 ones that we hadn't called yet, and that's Saskatoon Southeast, Chief Mistawasis, Prince Albert Northcote, Saskatoon Silver Springs, and Regina Wascana Plains. All of those except for Northcote went to the NDP. So that's part of that NDP 27 seats where it stands right now unofficially. If it holds and if the NDP keeps outperforming those are overperforming their mail-in ballots, they'll be in the legislature with 27 seats. The other one that's sort of outstanding but looks really good for the Saskatchewan Party is Willow Grove in Saskatoon. That would be Ken Cheveldayoff, and he would be the only quote-unquote urban seat out of Saskatoon and Regina for the Saskatchewan Party. So a shout out in Regina and a shout out in Saskatoon for the NDP.
Murray, what kind of government caucus does this leave Scott Moe with?
Well, rural one. And that's where the first problem lies. It's a problem both ways. Absolutely a problem both ways. I actually think in many ways it's a bigger problem for the NDP because they have a very urban one, urban northern. And while that's great if you're maybe in government and you're focused on delivery of specific issues, because if you look at health, social services, education, that might be more suited to sort of in urban environment issues, and they'd struggle to get an environment minister. But in opposition, it's a problem because they can't move forward in terms of reaching that other half of the province. They're going to be dealing with issues in those particular areas where they're going to be hypercritical of everything going on in health, education, et cetera, as they have been. And also because that's where the meat and potatoes are, and that's why they doubled their seats in the election. But I don't know if it's helpful in terms of expanding them. They have to reach out more. They have to present better than they obviously did in the election campaign. For the government, huge problem, obviously, because you're looking across the way at a very large, largely women, or certainly a significant number of women, a lot of them professionals, a lot of them well-educated, a lot of them already seasoned and capable in the legislature. It's going to be way different look, a way different house sitting from the gallery looking down at, after years of looking down at these little rumps of 12, 14 opposition members, they're going to cover the whole side. And that's physically going to look different and going to be different in this particular legislature. So right off the bat, there's going to be that. There's going to be issues like the change room policy that is going to immediately divide because the dynamic of school board trustees on the government side and teachers, tons of teachers in the opposition side. I think it's going to be really quite nasty off the hop. I hope everybody takes a breath and understands they have 4 years to get to dislike each other.
Yeah.
Exactly.
When is off the hop? People have been writing to ask me, when's this session start?
So I'll do the math for everyone. So November 9th is a Saturday. That will be the final count. The 11th is a holiday. That Remembrance Day is Monday. So I think we're going to need a cabinet Scheffel swearing in first, then they can't put the cabinet directly into that, you know, hornet's nest, as Murray just described. So they're going to give them a couple of weeks. Usually they like ending the fall sitting in the middle of December so they can get back in time for Christmas. So I would anticipate that we'll have a cabinet shuffle that first week. It was the exact day of the civic election 4 years ago. People may remember that they had to one of the cabinet ministers saying we're postponing the civic elections in
right.
Saskatoon and Swift Current and
that's
other places
right.
because of the blizzard. So and that was the day of the cabinet shuffle. So I think, you know, the 12th or 13th for that, then we'll have to have the swearing in of everyone, an election of a speaker, which will take on a little bit of an extra drama, I think.
Sure will.
And I just put this in Murray's ear. And, you know, what if Ken Cheveldayoff wanted to be the speaker and didn't want to be in cabinet? Wouldn't that be interesting for the government, right? They would need him in cabinet because he's the only Saskatoon-based MLA. He has the most experience. He was the only member of class of 2003 who's still around. So he's likely in there, but they have to do that. And then we have a throne speech as well. So a lot to pack into just about probably 3 weeks here at the end of November.
Who else will be in cabinet besides probably Ken Cheveldayoff?
Well, we'll assume Ken Cheveldayoff. He'll be absolutely patently ridiculous if he's not, is the only MLA left from a from the cities. First in, first out, by the way. He was the first city MLA elected for the SAS party. Like his brother Kevin would love the hockey player like that. A nice first guy off,
yeah.
last guy on. But beyond, I think, Cheveldayoff, I think we'll probably look at every one of the 10 surviving cabinet ministers to be reappointed to cabinet in very different positions. Because I can imagine, unless once again, the government isn't getting the message, and they might not be. Well, I guess we'll see whether there's much sincerity to what Scott Moe said on election night. But you got to move Jeremy Cockrell out of education. You got to move a few people around. You got to move. One of the problems that they have is the loss of who they had. If you look at Dustin Duncan, if you look at Don Morgan, if you look at Gord Wyant or even Donna Harpower, they either took on multiple portfolios or the heavier ones. Like Dustin Duncan could and would take on just about everything and did. Same with Don Morgan. I don't think they're going to have as many people with that capacity to do so. They'll still have someone like the Jim Reiters. Now, probably he's going to be pegged for finance because that's goes to usually your most senior trusted advisor. Now it's his role now that Paul Merriam and Donna Harpower are no longer part of that caucus. You're going to have to lean on people like Lori Carr, but you can't really put her back in social services, which is a huge problem. One might think that Ken Cheveldayoff would be a good fit for that, but it's a senior portfolio, but he could be used better elsewhere in terms of this. As I say, it's why he isn't in cabinet, I'm sure, goes back to the leadership in 2018. Maybe time for Scott Moe and the people around him to let that go. If they don't have the message right now that they have to do business differently, that they can't be as arrogant as they were in the rotunda, as we saw in terms of our inner dealings with them, that they can't, they have to be more open, they have to be more reaching out, then if they don't get that now, they're dead in a few years, regardless of this urban-rural split. New people are going to be a bit of a problem because you're going to have to lean heavily on them. You're going to want more women in cabinet, and they have the opportunity to do so. But whether they have the people that can do the job or whether they can actually fit them in nicely. I wrote a column this cabinet building is building from a pile of scrap wood because that's all pretty much he's got left over and a lot of green material. And the problem being is that that's not a great formula upon which to build a cabinet because you need experience and such. And I can't remember in a long time, other than a government change, a government going into it with so little experience. And it's quite stunning, really, if you think of this being a fifth-tier government and you think the natural transition. But between people that just don't fit in where they were, like Jeremy Cockrell. I don't know what you do with Jeremy Harrison other than keep him in economic development and keep him as far away from government house business as possible. You're right, the speaker thing is going to be absolutely fascinating. But there's so many elements, so many working moving parts in play right now. for Scott Moe. As Adam said, he's going to need all the time he gets between now and whenever the House opens to basically develop this cabinet.
Before you guys go, can we talk a little bit about voter turnout? It was, what, less than 53% last time we voted?
Yeah, just a shade under 53. Yeah.
And now?
Now we're over 53%, but we were at 53% at before mail-in ballots. I talked to Michael Bodo about this when he was available for media on when they did the mail-in counting on Wednesday, and he said, you know, we did our best to engage voters. We opened it up. We were really impressed with the advance voting. But Eric Grenier, as he said, I think on election night and other times, he said they found that advance voting doesn't mean people are motivated to vote. They just want to get it out of the way. They want more opportunities. So there's kind of that word of mouth of, hey, come on down. There's no one here. Come vote. But we're struggling to get to that 54-55%. I think they'd like to see it over 55%. I'll be really interested to see how this breaks down regionally, because we have those numbers from 2020, and it would kind of surprise you where some of the highest turnout. I think Dakota Arm River was the highest turnout, well over 65%. Regina Rochdale was over 65%, I believe, 4 years ago. Then you had places like Cumberland, 32%. So there is a big divide there. We talk about an urban-rural divide. There is a big divide when it comes to voter turnout, and not just in the rural and cities, but in some of the places, especially where it's a lower socioeconomic area, where there's a place where there's great distances for people to travel. That's where the voter turnout sometimes historically has been lower.
Why do you think, Marie, besides some of the things Adam just said, you know, distance from polls or other reasons, why are there so many people who just don't vote?
Are to blame, because all of us who add cynicism to the political system and by pointing out its flaws and the flaws of government, I think that's a bit of a turnoff. I think general disinterest and disengagement in society. People love to talk on social media, but you know, if Carla Beck had all the people on social media basically advising her on how she should be running her campaign, actually going out and campaigning for her, she probably would have won. And this is sort of the way we are as a society right now. We talk and talk and talk, and there's not people that actually do even the minimal, which is going out and getting out and voting. I was just looking at the numbers. I don't have it right in front of me, but I think it's about 1,600 and change that votes, if they change in those four key ridings, that the four closest SAS party ridings, we would have a Carla Beck government today. So there is motivation to do so. If I look at Saskatoon, Westview, I think it's 37 right now, the voter difference. 37 votes is a difference. And yeah, your individual votes don't make much of a difference, but neither does buying a lottery ticket. You know, and we still do more reward, I guess. But people have to understand the need, the duty, and the logic. Be quite frank, I would like to see voting tied to either penalty or incentive in terms of either giving people some kind of tax incentive to vote or penalize them if they don't, like they do in Australia. And I think things like that would bring into the habit of voting. If you vote, you're probably going to be more engaged for the next 4 years in the result. But the other problem being, there's so many factors, Stephanie, but the other problem is I think politicians don't want people to vote. They want their people to vote. And that's kind of what we saw in this election. Didn't work out as well for either party.
Thanks very much, you guys, for all of the times we've talked this week.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.